The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Dylan Taylor Lehman. He joins us on the telephone somewhere. He's written a book about Sealand, the true story of the world's most stubborn micronation and its eccentric royal family.
I'm pretty excited about this book in particular, too, because it is such a remarkable story. And I'm not quite sure how I first heard about Sealand, but, probably 10 to 15 years ago, it crossed my radar, and I kind of was following the story ever since then. And then I eventually realized that this is exactly the kind of thing I would like to research and write about and visit if I could. And so I just kind of developed the idea for this book, which is a comprehensive history of the Principality of Sealand.
And it's also really the story about one man, one very determined, tough guy.
This all takes place in southeastern England, and a man named Roy Bates was born in the Essex area, which is right on the North Sea, kind of by the Thames estuary. And he is often described as a kind of old school Englishman, an adventurer, you know, heedless of danger, you know, very brave and determined. And after serving in World War II, he took a series of interesting jobs and eventually realized the 9-to-5 life wasn't for him. And as it happened, right off the coast of England were these old naval forts, which had been built to shoot down incoming Nazi bombers. They'd been abandoned for about 20 years. And being the enterprising businessman that he was, he realized that one of these offshore forts could be quite useful for a number of reasons. And so he one day took one over and claimed it as his own.
But before he did that, he was locating himself on a different one. Apparently, there's several of these still around. And you also get into the background. You talk about the guy who designed these, and he sounds like kind of a crazy genius. Tell us about this guy.
Yeah, these were called the Monsell Naval and their Army forts as well. And they were designed by a guy named Guy Anson Monsell, which is, it seemed kind of like a little officious little architect, but he had a really interesting slant on the profession. And he after working in a concrete production facility, a lot of his designs involved concrete, including concrete hulled boats and landing platforms and things like that, which would go on to be used during World War II. But he designed these really unorthodox forts, which were two large concrete pillars that kind of look like silos, which were on a hollow concrete base that were floated out into the ocean and sunk. And so the concrete silos stuck out over the surface of the water. A metal superstructure was laid on top with anti-aircraft guns and things like that. And so there were a number of these forts with really strange silhouettes dotting the southeastern English coast.
And one of the reasons for the strange silhouettes was to kind of throw off bombers that were coming in, right?
Yeah, that's what the rationale was. They were painted, you know, in a way to kind of camouflage them. But, yeah, it's hard to describe without seeing them. It's kind of like two soup cans with, like, a book laid across the top. And they're spaced apart and laid out in such a way that, yeah, they were hard to see and would ideally be fairly surprising to the bombers that, you know, wouldn't be expecting incoming fire that far out to sea.
Dylan, you also have these great anecdotes. One of them that stuck with me was the one about these guys are on this platform, and it's during the war, and they see this magnetic mine floating towards them, and it's coming closer and closer, and they're trying to shoot it. You remember that one?
Oh, absolutely.
They're not very good shots, though, are they?
No, I mean, fortunately, the mine ended up passing, you know, between the legs right underneath the fort. But, yeah, and that's what's really kind of so compelling about these about these designs. It's like you can't board them from below because you're at the mercy of whoever is at top, up top. But that also means that once you're on the fort, if you don't have a way off, you're pretty much stuck there. And, you know, these forts, the surface area is probably that of a large house, and they had up to 120 men stationed out there at one time, which would be an extremely can be an extremely claustrophobic experience, you know, let alone adding in the danger of explosives coming at you or planes flying by shooting at you and that kind of thing.
And the rank and file troops had to sleep down below where there was no sunlight. It was dark. They could hear all this weird ocean noise and kind of drove them crazy. Didn't one guy just jump off just to get off the thing?
Yeah, that's what they developed a term called Fort Madness for the paranoia and isolation that came with being out there. So, yeah, one guy reportedly jumped off. And I also heard that, you know, the commanding officers would the men were compelled to take up some kind of hobby to keep their mind occupied. So they did pottery and painting and music and things like that.
Mm. Okay, let's talk some more about Paddy Roy Bates and how he developed an interest in these platforms and what his initial business was. He wasn't on the one destined to be Sealand. He was on a different one. What was he up to? I find this to be one of the most fascinating parts of the whole story.
There are four of these forts that look like the one that would become Sealand, and he initially took over a fort which was 3 miles off the British coast, and that distance will come, you know, play much importance in the story later on. But at the time that he and his 14-year-old son, or even younger, his young son Michael, explored this fort, there was a phenomenon going on in Britain at the time called the radio pirate era, or pirate radio era, sorry. And that was because the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, wouldn't play the rock and roll on the airwaves that people wanted to hear. And so all these freewheeling DJs took to the seas and these abandoned forts to start their own pirate radio stations, ideally outside of British jurisdiction. And so Paddy Roy Bates, that's what the initial plan was. He was going to become a radio pirate, and this fort would serve as his radio station.
And he started something called Radio Essex and had all these DJs working for him, and they would bring the DJs out there, and they were literally stranded. Sometimes they ran out of food. They nearly starved to death. They'd stay out there for weeks.
Yeah, conditions were Spartan, but you know, all the DJs were, they signed up for the adventure. They were, you know, in their early 20s at their oldest and just living the rock and roll lifestyle. And this, you know, quasi-legal enterprise, which become, the stakes would become a little higher later on. But it was, you know, worth some of the pain because it was just such a revolutionary, exciting experience. And, you know, all in all, a pretty harmless Robin Hood type thing. I mean, you know, you're fighting to play rock and roll on the radio. So that's, you know, that's something a lot most people can get behind for sure.
Well, it didn't stay harmless, did it? And we have a series of takeover attempts on these platforms that you delineate throughout the book. Some very bizarre antagonistic exchanges involving Molotov cocktails and gunfire and a lot of wild activity. A lot of it centered around Michael, Roy Bates' son. But first, I think we need to explain to our listeners, what are the legalities here as far as how can they occupy something that belongs to the British government? You explain this in the book and the differences between the first platform where he had this radio station and then the eventual platform that became Sealand.
Sure. So the first fort that he took over was called Knock John. And as mentioned, that was 3 miles from shore just short of 3 miles from shore, depending on how you measured it. And at the time, 3 miles was the end of British territorial waters. And so Roy Bates ultimately got hauled into court for broadcasting violations, and it was determined that the British law did apply to him because he was within that 3 mile limit. And so he realized that there was another fort 6 miles out which was, of course, you know, from any way you measured it, definitely outside of British territorial waters and in international waters where British law didn't apply. And so that was certainly the worked in their benefit, both for, you know, future broadcasting purposes, but would also play an extremely critical part in Sealand's Declaration of Independence. But a series of kind of official oversights and even some decisions by British courts suggested that Britain definitely didn't have control over Rough's Tower, which would become Sealand, which, of course, very much worked in favor of the Sealanders' claims on the territory.
And when he initially switched to the other platform, he had hoped to continue being a radio broadcaster, but that just wasn't going to work out. And so this begins the long series of episodes and the various morphings of what Sealand was. Let's talk about how Sealand became a micronation. And what is a micronation?
A micronation is a territory that's declared often within the boundaries of another more recognized territory. And so you have everyone declaring, or micronationalists, you know, they'll declare the property they live on to be their own country. or you have cases like Sealand or some other strange geographies elsewhere in the world that do have some arguable historic or, sort of legalistic claim to some kind of independence. And so micronations are declared for reasons serious and tongue-in-cheek alike, and Sealand is definitely, you know, the grandfather of modern-day micronationalism.
The last time we had you on your program, you were still working on this book, and I'm going to assume, based on the timeline I saw in the book, that after I interviewed you, you went to Sealand.
Yeah, it was. I think I remember saying, you know, that was probably like my ultimate dream come true, if I could go set foot on the platform. And yeah, I somehow was able to make that happen. And the book is certainly all the better for it. My life was deeply enriched by that experience. And it was very cool to be able to meet and befriend the family behind the Sealand story, you know, who I'd been reading about and writing about for such a long time. So to meet them in real life and hear more of their stories and more of their insights was really a very special experience that, you know, just made the story that much more fun to tell and that much more personal for me.
Dylan Taylor Lehman joins us. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. We're talking about Sealand, the true story of the world's most stubborn micronation and its eccentric royal family. I alluded to the violent encounters that took place around Sealand. And the first notable one that took place around a platform involved rival radio station crews. And Michael, the son, is a key figure in a lot of these violent confrontations. Even as a young teenager, he stopped going to school and lived out on the platform, and he was out there guarding the thing and willing to toss Molotov cocktails at passing boats and shooting at people. It's a miracle he didn't kill anybody.
That side of the story is really fascinating and pretty bonkers. I mean, I mentioned earlier that pirate radio was a relatively harmless pursuit, but the stations did become pretty financially successful and listened to by truly millions of people. So there was a lot of money involved, which of course can lead to some pretty serious conflicts. So one radio boss killed another, and these forts were valuable commodities. So there were constantly battles and takeover attempts involving, as you said, Molotov cocktails, in some cases gunshots, definitely some fist fights and things like that. And Michael Bates, who was Roy Bates's son, was a 12-year-old when they first explored the fort. And so by the time he was 13, 14, he was, you know, pretty caught up in holding on to the fort and all the work that went into running these radio stations and, you know, having to go back to boarding school while knowing all this was going on did not sit well with him. And so he eventually persuaded his parents to let him drop out and help out with the fort. And eventually, I mean, he sometimes by himself or sometimes with another person or two was tasked with defending the fort at all costs. And when I talked to Michael last spring, he was stunned, you know, being a parent and now grandparent himself, that, you know, his dad left him alone on the fort with some guns. And if it came down to whether he should shoot someone or not, you know, his dad left that choice up to him based on the circumstances. And, you know, that's a pretty wild upbringing to have, for sure.
Pretty wild. But the wildest takeover, in my view, is the one by these Germans or Dutch or this group of very strange guys. This is the most unusual setup you've got going here. And these people are still involved. There's like a shadow government, right?
Yeah, this is a pivotal moment in Sealandic history. Sealand was declared independent in September 1967, and by 1973, it had grown in prominence a bit. I mean, appeared in the media, and the country had issued its own stamps, passports, some coins, and, you know, was really trying to establish itself. And that caught the attention of this group of Germans and Dutchmen who, for reasons that have been lost of time, have got in touch with Roy Bates, and they worked out a partnership where they would try to do a couple of things, gain official recognition from more recognized countries or international bodies like the UN. They would try to get some investors on board to expand Sealand's footprint, and they were eventually, you know, trying to assert Sealand sovereignty so they could develop offshore banking services and other pursuits like that, that, you know, they would be subject to Sealandic law.
It seems like they're criminals, though, from their behavior.
Yeah, so eventually it kind of came to light that a lot of these guys were pretty sketchy characters involved in a number of confidence schemes. Eventually, that all came to a head when it came to the Sealandic situation, which culminated in the coup of 1978, you know, World War Sealand, where Michael, who by this time was in his mid to late 20s, was out on the fort by himself. A group of these men, these Germans, flew in, claimed that Roy had given them permission to take over the fort. Michael was a little sketched out and then eventually got locked in a closet and taken hostage, as these Germans, of course, then, you know, took control of Sealand.
And to this day, the people who took over this claim are still claiming that they are the real government of Sealand.
Right. So this touched off a pretty fascinating series of events. Spoiler alert, the Sealanders took back over the country in a very heroic counter coup, put some of these traitors on trial, expelled them from the country, and you know, over the decades, this exile government has its own alternate version of Sealand, which is a very surreal take on the whole thing, and still operate to this day. And it still is sort of everyone involved with the exile government is definitely a pretty sketchy character, to say the least.
Yeah, that was really straight out of James Bond. In fact, didn't they have a helicopter pilot who actually was in a James Bond movie?
Yeah, the counter coup, Roy Bates marshaled some of his friends, one of whom was a stunt pilot in movies and had his own helicopter, and was, by all accounts, just thrilled to be taking part in an actual raid like this. And he flew them out there, and yeah, they descended onto the fort via ropes, and they had, you know, Michael had a sawed-off shotgun with him, and they really took over the fort. And there are all kinds of incredible photos of these captors you know, black eyes and bloody noses, tied up and paraded around for the press who got wind of the story and came out to cover this turn of events.
I've neglected to mention Mrs. Bates. She is a very strong force in this family and a tough woman. She, along with Michael, fiercely defended this platform. Wasn't there some sort of a scene, I don't know if this is for publicity, where she appears to be pregnant and then she tears open her blouse and rips out a submachine gun?
That's part of the lore that the Sealanders admitted was not entirely accurate. But yeah, Joan Bates, she met Roy in 1948. They fell in love and were married within 6 weeks, and Joan said that even that had taken too long, and they were an inseparable pair their whole lives, you know, really kind of filling in each other's weaknesses and complementing each other's strengths. And she played a pivotal role in all the businesses that Roy started, including the radio station. And, you know, she helped train the DJs and coordinate shipments and really had a heavy hand in all of that. And then when it came to Sealand too, you know, she kind of, this is a life we're taking, and, you know, this is what we're doing now. And, you know, played a key role in the development of Sealand and the direction it took throughout the decades as well.
And it's a very topsy-turvy story. We can't tell from 1 minute to the next whether Roy Bates is a millionaire or whether he doesn't have any money. And you just mentioned these other family businesses. One of them revolved around some sort of an aquatic plant that they harvested, and then another one involved some sort of a mussel or a cockerel, they call it, that they were harvesting. Tell us about some of these other business enterprises.
That's kind of mysterious. I mean, was he a self-made millionaire? Was he just kind of a wheeler dealer? But I think it's kind of in the middle. I mean, he did operate a number of businesses. Some were pretty successful, including this, as you mentioned, a white weed harvesting business, which is, I believe, a type of coral that is used in decorative flower arrangements. And so that's kind of an interesting part of the story because, you know, he grew up near the water, but his family wasn't on the water, and he changed that. I mean, he bought some fishing boats and they undertook this white weed harvesting business. And to this day, the family runs a cockling business, which are these little edible mollusks that can be found in abundance in the Thames Estuary and in the North Sea. And so, yeah, they forged a life, a fairly successful life for themselves as fishermen, essentially, and still do that to this day. And that's helped pay for the Sealand endeavor for decades.
Dylan Taylor Lehman joins us. His book is Sealand, The True Story of the World's Most Stubborn Micronation and Its Eccentric Royal Family. And you have a number of anecdotes in here where I'm guessing that sometimes you're repeating something that you heard, but you're not sure whether it really happened, but it's certainly interesting to hear. And one in particular that I was amused by was the time maybe this happened. Some rock band showed up at the Bates house and went in and talked to Roy Bates and said, "Here, listen to our tape. You need to play our tape on your pirate radio station." And supposedly it was the Rolling Stones, and he basically said, "That music's a bunch of garbage."
Yeah, from what I understand, from what his family told me, you know, he's a fan of the kind of crooners and music of that era. So, yeah, he didn't even necessarily like rock and roll, but, you know, certainly saw its viability.
Mm. Okay, the last we see of Sealand in your book, it's in a situation now where it has a couple guys who are caretakers. Is that still the way the setup is?
Yes, yeah, and that's how I was able to visit.
So what's going on there now? Tell us the current situation.
So today, the fort is manned at any given time by typically one of two people, a man named Joe and a man named Mike. Joe's been involved with Sealand for about 10 years and Mike more than three decades. And they alternate, weather allowing, 2 week stints on Sealand. And that is their full-time jobs. And the Bates family pays them a salary to do that. And when I was able to visit, it was because they were swapping out their shifts. And so I sailed out on a little rusty lobster boat with Joe, who was beginning his tenure or his stint on the fort, and swapping out Mike, who was going to come back and, you know, stay on land for a couple of weeks. And as mentioned, it's typically for 2 weeks, but Joe told me, you know, if the weather gets bad, I mean, there's no way to get them off. So he's been out there for 4+ weeks at a time, which can be pretty quite an experience, I guess.
Did you stay out there for 2 weeks?
No, unfortunately, I would just for the day, basically.
Okay.
This lobster boat was dropping Joe off, was going out to check its traps.
Oh.
The fishermen were going out to grab their harvest, and then on the way back in, we were picked up and brought back to shore.
Well, that was lucky. We haven't even had time to hit the 1990s when the dot-com thing hit, and they wanted to turn Sealand into a big computer zone with lots of wild computer stuff going on. We'll leave that to readers to discover. That's another really fascinating aspect of the story.
Yeah, and that too is dependent on its unique extraterritorial status, and that whole, you know, predicated on the idea that it is international waters and can effectively make its own laws.
Well, Dylan, the last time we had you on was for your book about the Miami Township Board of Trustees, and I'm guessing that you're expecting a little wider audience for this one.
Yeah, I mean, not to discredit the lives of Miami Township, but yes, that was perhaps a little bit more of a niche interest. But I mean, Sealand, just by, you know, virtue of it being around for more than 50 years, has a pretty avid following and a lot of would-be citizens. So yeah, I hope there are some people out there that are interested in hearing more about this. About Sealand's history.
Well, Dylan, I loved that book about the Miami Township Board of Trustees. I was just saying it's just a little more narrow audience. And
I like it a lot too, but I can appreciate why the audience might be a little smaller.
I'm going to take a wild guess that your next project is about landfills. What are you working on?
I haven't had any recent landfill experience, but I'm still working on a project about this legendary El Paso private eye who lost his hands when he was a teenager and has two metal hooks for hands, and he's been made this remarkable career for himself and has been a practicing private eye for over 60 years. So I'm working on a biography about him and just an overview of some of the really interesting things he's worked on.
Wow.
Throughout his life, and then always have a bevy of articles that I'm working on too, which has been fun.
Well, we'll look forward to that, Dylan. And I guess I should note that you were formerly a reporter for the Yellow Springs News, and that's how I got to know you. And it's really been great having you back on the airwaves here in Southwest Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, Yellow Springs, that was such an important and interesting and special time in my life. And yeah, I definitely remember it fondly, and I'm very grateful for everyone I've been able to meet through that.
Well, thanks for your time, Dylan.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much.
My guest has been Dylan Taylor Lehman. The book is Sealand, The True Story of the World's Most Stubborn Micronation and Its Eccentric Royal Family. Just hot off the press. The ink in mine is still wet. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.